Aware of this fact, but the world was supposed to end in 1844. Of course, that didn't happen. We're still here. But a man by the name of William Miller, a man of fairly humble beginnings, a farmer and served as a sheriff and justice of the peace in Vermont, believed that the prophecy of Daniel 8 and verse 14 was a prediction of the end of the world. In Daniel, the 8th chapter, we're in the midst of some of the apocalyptic language of Daniel, some of the visions that Daniel saw. I'm going to read verses 13 and 14, and then I'll explain to you how it is that William Miller came to the conclusion that verse 14 would tell him when the end of the world would occur. In verse 13 of Daniel 8, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, 'For how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot?' And he said to me, 'For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be restored to its rightful state.'" And Mr. Miller decided that in prophetic language, a day is equal to a year. And so he took the time of this prophecy, or at least the time that it was supposed by Bishop Usher to have occurred, about 456 or 457 B.C., and he took the 2,300 days, turned them into 2,300 years, and then he calculated from 457 to the front, and he comes up with 1844. And his decision was, his understanding was, that that represented when the sanctuary would be cleansed by fire and the world would end. And he began preaching that idea about 25 years before 1844. And he believed that the world would end sometime during that Hebrew year that constituted March of 1843 to March of 1844. And so sometime in that year would be the end of the world. Well, March 1844 passed. And another date was quickly set, a date that was 7 months and 10 days later, October 22nd, 1844. It was decided that there was a tarrying time. One of William Miller's followers, and he had become very popular as a speaker. He had over 50,000 people who were very much convinced that the world was coming to an end, and they were his followers. And one of them came up with the idea that you had to go to the Day of Atonement, 7 month, 10th day. And so that would take it from March to October 22nd, 1844. That is now known as the Great Disappointment Day in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. This is a short quotation from a blog by Jeff Gang. He is a pastor of a Seventh-day Adventist church in Anaheim, California. Wrote this back on October 22nd, 2010. It was 166-year anniversary. Now we're at 170 this year. He says, "My denomination, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, was conceived in disappointment. It happened 166 years ago today, October 22nd, 1844. That morning, thousands of Christians gathered together around the United States, mostly New England, to await the second coming of Jesus. People called the Millerites because of the movement's leader, William Miller. They came from many different churches at the time, from Baptists to Presbyterians. Many of them, I think he left out a word there, were forced to leave their churches because of their radical ideas. And that has become an annual celebration, so to speak, the Great Disappointment Day. What happened, of course, was that Jesus didn't return. And eventually, well, I should say pretty much at the time of October 22nd, most of Miller's followers were disillusioned and stopped following him. They were scattered. But there was a group in New England that was led by a man by the name of James White, married to Ellen Gould White, or Gould White, Ellen G. White, she's usually known as. And that group of Millerites, former Millerites in New England, basically was the foundation for what we know today as the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I thought this was kind of interesting. This was on Jeff Gang's site. And I'm not sure if this plaque, wherever it is, he didn't identify where it is, but I'm wondering if that's not where this group, the Whites and the others who worship with them, if that isn't where these people were worshiping or were at the time that, as he says, the birthplace of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The Seventh-day Adventist Church has some rather attractive characteristics, particularly in a day when a lot of religious groups are not very faithful to the Word of God. They don't make any pretense to be. But the Seventh-day Adventist Church teaches that the Bible is the inspired Word of God, and at least claim that the Bible is the, quote, only standard of faith and practice for Christians. They embrace the sola scriptura, only the scriptures, principle of the Reformation movement back in Europe. And they really don't seem to have any recognized creeds, although you can find a statement of their beliefs that apparently most Seventh-day Adventists would subscribe to on their website. It's easy to find. And they talk about their 28 fundamental beliefs, and I'm going to use some of those, a couple of them this evening, to let them represent their own beliefs. But it's attractive to me, it's impressive that they haven't embraced, like so many denominational groups have, some sort of creed statement or have denigrated the inspiration of the Scriptures. The Seventh-day Adventist Church furthermore teaches that the only scriptural reason for divorce is fornication. That's unusual among religious groups today. And at least through my personal experience and what I've been able to derive from other writings, Seventh-day Adventists, the members, tend to be rather conservative in their daily lives. There are some groups that teach error, and yet they are conservative, morally conservative, socially conservative individuals. And I think the Seventh-day Adventists are in that category. At the same time, however, the Seventh-day Adventist Church does teach a number of things with which I would disagree, and I suggest that probably you would as well. And I'm going to give you not an all-inclusive list, just a handful of things. Adventists do not believe in the necessity of baptism for forgiveness of sins. They believe in water baptism as immersion, but they believe an individual saved at the point of faith. Baptism is something that comes later on and symbolizes the salvation that has already occurred in their viewpoint. Adventists believe in modern-day miraculous spiritual gifts, particularly the gifts of prophecy and healing. Those are two gifts that they list that are clearly, I think, intended to be miraculous spiritual gifts. Adventists believe in foot washing, what they call the ordinance of humility. They only observe the Lord's Supper four times a year, quarterly in their practice. Excuse me. And prior or as a prelude to observing the Lord's Supper, they have this ceremony, and it's literally a foot-washing ceremony. And that's because Jesus, on the night that He instituted the Lord's Supper, washed His disciples' feet and told them that they ought to do what He had done. And we've talked about that. I believe that's a misunderstanding of what Jesus intended there, but that's what they do. They literally have a foot-washing ceremony. And believe that's a Christian spiritual responsibility to participate in that. Adventists believe in the keeping of the Sabbath day. The Seventh-day Adventists believe that we ought to keep the Sabbath, even as Jesus kept the Sabbath, as the Jews kept the Sabbath. Now, my purpose this evening is very, very simple. I want to try to demonstrate, and I'm not going to use every argument that we could talk about. I'm going to focus on one or two primary arguments. But I want to demonstrate that Christians are not obligated to keep the Sabbath under the covenant of Jesus Christ. I want to present for you two of their viewpoints, the first one concerning the law of Moses, and the second one concerning the Sabbath observance. And of course, those are related, as you'll see in just a moment. This is an excerpt from their 28 fundamental beliefs. There's the website where you can find it if you want to go and read it for yourself. And this is what they say about the Mosaic Law, or the Law of God. It's under the title or under the heading of Law of God. The great principles of God's law are embodied in the Ten Commandments and exemplified in the life of Christ. They express God's love, will, and purposes concerning human conduct and relationships, and are binding upon all people in every age. These precepts are the basis of God's covenant with His people and the standard in God's judgment. Now, two things I want you to notice very quickly, and that is that they do not make any distinction between the God's covenant with Israel and God's covenant with people in general. They just talk about the covenant of God, and as far as they're concerned, the Ten Commandments form a part of that covenant. And that's the second point, and that is that these principles, these Ten Commandments that illustrate these principles, are binding upon all people in every age. And so they believe, like a lot of religious groups for that matter believe, that we are still living under and are responsible to the Ten Commandments. And of course, that would include the Sabbath restrictions or the obligation to keep the Sabbath holy as the fourth commandment. And so I want to talk just a little bit about our relationship to the law of Moses. And perhaps the best way to begin that discussion is to look at some relevant facts about the law of Moses. And perhaps the most neglected fact among religious people in general is that the Mosaic law was given to the Israelites, not mankind in general. One would think if you listen to various pastors or religious groups as they teach about the Ten Commandments, even some of our political figures in the state of Alabama act as though the Ten Commandments were given for all time to all people, and we are responsible to them even as the Israelites were. But that's just not the case. In fact, when we go back to Exodus, the 19th chapter, when the Lord speaks through Moses to Israel, at the very time when the Ten Commandments are about to be given from Mount Sinai, this is what He says in the first six verses of Exodus 19. On the third new moon, after the people of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. They set out from Rephidim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they encamped in the wilderness. There Israel encamped before the mountain while Moses went up to God. The Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying... And the reason I put all that up there is I want you to see the context of these statements. This is when Israel has gathered at Mount Sinai. This is Israel that God is speaking to. And that's plain here in the text of verse 3, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine." Now, I think we need to freely grant, we need to understand, God is king over all nations. He's sovereign over all people, not just Israel. But He selected the nation of Israel as His special possession, obviously for the purpose of bringing a Messiah, preserving a holy lineage for the coming king of His New Testament kingdom. And He says, "You shall be my treasured possession among all peoples." And so for this people, He gave a specific and special covenant. "For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel." And of course, in chapter 20 of Exodus, the Ten Commandments are given to the people. They were given to Israel. They weren't given to all people or all men everywhere. Now, when you get to Deuteronomy chapter 4, we're on the other side of the wilderness wandering 40 years later, and Moses is reminding the people of things that have happened in their past. I want you to notice very quickly, and I neglected to change my reference down here. I've got verse 1, and then I want you to notice I jumped to verse 8. That's just simply so I could keep the material that I wanted you to see as pertinent together. Look at verse 1. He says, "And now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the rules that I am teaching you and do them, that you may live and go in and take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you. And someone says, well, of course he addresses Israel. That's who was present. That's who Moses was leading. Fine. My question is, where do you find these kind of statements made to other nations with respect to the law of Moses? Crickets. There aren't any other statements like that. In fact, listen to what he says in verse 8. And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today? According to those who teach that the Ten Commandments are for all men, every nation was given those statutes. You see that? But here in verse 8, it becomes clear that a distinction is being made between Israel and the rest of the nations. What other nation is getting a law like you have? What's the answer to that? No other nation. Because that covenant was given specifically to Israel, not given to mankind in general. In verse 13, and he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, that is, the Ten Commandments, and he wrote them on two tablets of stone. If there's any doubt about what we're talking about, we are talking about the Ten Commandments here. Now, in the book of Romans, in chapter 2, the Apostle Paul talked about the fact that each man will be judged by the standard to which he was accountable. And he mentions that the Gentiles were without law. Now, how could that be? How could that be if, in fact, the Ten Commandments were intended to govern all nations equally? Wouldn't the Gentiles then also have been under the same law that the Israelites would have been under? Certainly. And yet, Paul makes a distinction between Jews and Gentiles in Romans 2 with respect to the standard to which they are going to be held accountable. He says in 1 Corinthians the 9th chapter, verse 21, that we're under the law of Christ. The law of Christ, not the law of Moses. Where is the passage that teaches that Gentiles were or are responsible to keep the Mosaic law? Now, I want to make an observation here because of what was said in the quotation from the Adventist document. I believe that the Ten Commandments are basically a moral skeleton, not just for the Old Covenant, but that those same principles do in fact form a basis or a foundation for the New Covenant. I don't think it's right for us to steal today just because we're not under the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, one of which says, "Thou shalt not steal." I don't think I can commit adultery just because I'm not under the commandment that says, "Thou shalt not commit adultery" in Exodus 20, but I'm under the New Covenant. The New Covenant has the same precepts except for one of those commandments, and that's the key point. The Sabbath restrictions are not reiterated in the New Covenant, while the other principles of the Decalogue are. And so we'll come to that a little bit later on, but I wanted to make that observation at this point. The Mosaic Law is no longer binding on anyone. It's not just that it's not binding on Gentiles. It's not even binding on Jews. And Paul makes that observation in Romans the 7th chapter, in verses 4 through 7, where he says, he uses the illustration in verses 2 and 3 of marriage, how that a woman is bound to her husband for so long as he lives. If he dies, then she's free to be married to somebody else. But he begins chapter 7 and verse 1 saying, you know, brethren, that a man's responsible to the law. It's binding on him only as long as he lives. So then he says, likewise, my brothers, you also have died to the law through the body of Christ, so that you may belong to another, to him who has been raised from the dead, Jesus, in order that we may bear fruit for God. For while we were living in the flesh, our sinful passions aroused by the law were at work in our members to bear fruit for death. Now, these are the key phrases. Verse 6, but now we are released from the law. Well, the only people who were ever responsible to the law of Moses were the Israelites, were the Jews. And Paul says, we're released from the law. Why? Well, you died to the law so that you could be married to Christ. He actually flips the illustration. I won't get into all of that. It's kind of interesting discussion. But someone says, well, but